Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for June 28, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. First segment, in about 5 minutes or so, we'll be talking with Robert Frank, who is a Wall Street Journal reporter, who writes their Wealth Report blog and has a new book out called Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich. A lot of coverage of wealth in the United States over the last couple of decades has been almost a species of pornography, and Robert Frank does a bit of that, but he's also an intelligent and sophisticated reporter, so we'll talk to him about the new rich, who are really lording it all over us like never before, or at least like 60 or 100 years ago. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear an interview I recorded earlier this week with Camilo Mejia, who's been on this show several times, but Camilo was a sergeant in the National Guard who deserted from his platoon in Iraq on when he was on leave here in the United States, and did so for political and moral reasons, did some time in an Army jail, and has now got a new book out about his experience in the Army and why he left Iraq and why he decided to desert and put himself at considerable risk. And the book, Road from Our Ramadi, The Private Rebellion of Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia, and that's about half an hour from now. And I don't use this show as a personal soapbox very often, but I do want to complain about you bicycle riders out there. You're some of the worst drivers in New York City. I just nearly got clipped by a guy who's going the wrong way down a one-way street. They run red lights. They ride in the sidewalk. Sometimes they do all those things, and that's really not nice. We need fewer cars and more bicycles if we're going to avert ecological catastrophe, but please be kind to pedestrians when you're riding a bicycle. And, you know, I've even experienced as a driver that bicyclists do some pretty stupid things. Not as dumb as the skateboarders, but really, be careful and watch where you're going. A bicycle can do some damage, even though it may not seem that way. And now, a follow-up to my comments on China the other week, which were inspired by some standard pseudo-radical analysis of that country, which sees it as little more than a slave labor camp. Those remarks focused on China's rise as an economic power well beyond the caricature of the country as a low-end subcontractor. But there's also an international political dimension to China's rise that I didn't have time to get into, but a few words about that right now. Yesterday's Financial Times reported that the $5 billion China-Africa Development Fund, which Beijing is promoting as an economic assistance plan, is essentially a scheme to promote Chinese business and economic interests. The fund will finance natural resource projects designed to feed China's insatiable demand for basic commodities like oil and minerals. It will also fund infrastructure products, projects, at least 70% of which will be built by Chinese contractors, and industrial parks that will house Chinese manufacturers. There will no doubt be some spillover benefits to African economies, but it looks like those will be byproducts of the development schemes and not the main events. This practice of tying foreign aid to purchases from the source country has fallen into disrepute, even among the official development establishment. But by prohibiting recipient countries from shopping around for the best deal they can find on world markets, the effectiveness of such aid, insofar as such aid is effective at all, is thought to be reduced by about as much as a quarter. It may be to benefit. It may be to Africa's benefit to diversify the ranks of its neocolonial masters. But let's be clear on the fact that China is assuming a neocolonial role in Africa. Imperialism isn't just about white people anymore. And another follow-up, this to last week's comments on private equity, specifically the Blackstone Group, the star of the field. Private equity, or PE, has been one of the dominant forces in the financial markets over the last several years. PE funds, and there are nearly 200 of them around the world, the biggest of them right here in the USA, consist of huge pools of capital contributed by institutional investors like pension funds and university endowments, along with some very rich individuals. What PE does is buy up whole companies in the hope of selling them again a few years later at a higher price. And how do they work this magic? By cutting costs and boosting profits, if all goes well. And how do they do that? By cutting wages, laying people off, closing down divisions, and cutting back on investment. All those things, in other words, that are supposed to drive economic growth over the long term and make it possible for most of us to get by in this profit-driven system. In the process, the people who run PE funds have made themselves very rich. And all the money they've pumped into the stock market in recent years as they buy up companies has driven the market higher, even though the broader economy hasn't been doing all that well. In part, it may be because of all that PE magic. Several months ago, Blackstone, one of the most successful of the groups, decided to take itself public, turning what was once a partnership controlled by a handful of people into a public company by selling stock in the open market. I thought from the first that this was an interesting signal. It looked to me like these very smart guys are trying to cash their way out before the bubble burst. Well, Blackstone made its debut as a public, and public in this context means a company with many outside shareholders, not some sort of socialist enterprise. They made that debut last Friday at $31 a share. The stock traded higher for a little while, but it sank back, and as I'm speaking, I think it closed below 30. This is not typical behavior for a new stock. It usually trades strongly for a while. So it looks to me that these guys timed it very well. The partners are now splitting $4 billion among themselves, and the people who bought their stock are holding losses. What this also suggests is that the exuberant financial markets of recent years are in the process of becoming less exuberant. We're now seeing increasing signs of financial troubles, troubles that started in the so-called subprime mortgage sector, a side effect of the bursting of the housing bubble, but now look to be moving beyond that sector. It reminds me of the late 1980s, just as that decade's mania was coming to an end. That was followed by 3 years of economic stagnation, which were strongly felt here in New York because Wall Street took such a sharp hit. The upside to this possible downside for New Yorkers is that rents may come down, and all those luxury high-rises they've been building may stay empty once they're done, or maybe they'll be occupied by some non-luxury people. And finally, the Federal Reserve left interest rates unchanged at its policy-setting meeting this afternoon. No surprise there. But the statement they released with the decision sounded like they were still worried about inflation risks. What they really mean is that the unemployment rate is too low, and they won't be happy until it rises a bit. I've been saying this for months now, as regular listeners may know. Many of the finest, high-priced minds on Wall Street, and it's pretty funny to be sitting on Wall Street as I say this, disagreed with me by saying the Fed will cut interest rates soon. They were wrong, and I was right, and you didn't have to pay thousands of dollars to hear my analysis either. Okay, let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Robert Frank. A bit of Randy Newman's song from late 80s, I think, with Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits playing guitar, Money That Matters. And I know that was a pop hit, so shoot me. And now we're joined by Robert Frank, who is a Wall Street Journal reporter and the author of the book Richestan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich, just out from Crown Publishers. Welcome to WBAI, Robert.
Thank you.
So Richestan, it's a foreign country, huh?
It is. I mean, the rich in America have now become so numerous. There are now 9 million millionaire households in America that, in a sense, they form their own country. They also have more wealth than most countries. The top 1% of Americans now control $17 trillion, that's with a T, trillion dollars in wealth. And most importantly, they lead lives that are so different from the rest of Americans that, to me, it was like a foreign country. I called it Richestan.
And the Stan suffix sometimes is used jokingly to imply a despotic realm. Are you suggesting that?
Well, I was using it just because it immediately connotes a country, but it's also to connote the fact that today's wealthy are sort of tribal in their habits and in some ways kind of backward.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they for many of these people, you know, money is the ultimate sort of achievement and is, for them, at least they thought, the key to happiness. And many of them, as you read in the book, money does not equal happiness for them. So they've kind of gone about their lives in a backward way.
I want to come back to the happiness theme towards the
sure.
end of this. But sometimes people say they don't understand why rich people need more money. You know, once you reach, you know, X million dollars, isn't that enough? Why not stop there? Did your research come up with any enlightening answers to that question?
Well, you know, there's something about the psychology of people who pursue wealth that, that there's this built-in sort of sense of dissatisfaction. No matter how much money they have, there is always somebody with more money. And so I think secretly all these people want to be Bill Gates. And if they're not Bill Gates, they're constantly frustrated that they're not the richest person in America or the world. And they're driven by the desire, the competitive desire to be the richest, to have the most, to have the biggest yacht, to have the nicest house, to have the greatest number of household staff, whatever it might be. And so these people are sort of, they're optimistic because they're always trying to achieve that, but they're also very unhappy because they never can achieve that goal of being the richest.
How did you come upon this strange beat?
Well, I was an overseas correspondent for years, and my last posting was in Southeast Asia, where I was covering Vietnam and Cambodia and Thailand and the Philippines. And when I came back to the U.S. in 2002, I noticed the extraordinary amount of wealth that had cropped up in America during the time that I was gone. And so I kind of wanted to know, who are these people? Who's building all these giant mansions? Who's buying all these yachts and these cars? And as I looked into it more, it was very natural for me to look at this world as a foreign country because their lives were so different from mine. So I just took my skills as a foreign correspondent and applied them to the American rich and said, hey, this is like a foreign country.
Let's do a little bit of history here.
Early
in the book, you draw a contrast between the kinds of wealth that we saw going into the early 1980s, so old money, inherited money,
right,
and the new fortunes that started emerging. I would sort of date the change with the beginning of the bull market in August 1982. It's sort of a big cultural economic shift at that moment.
Right.
But what was the how did things change, and how did the old money contrast with the new fortunes that have been developed over the last 20, 25 years?
Well, until the 1980s, wealth in America was first and foremost a fairly small community. I mean, just by numbers, there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of millionaires instead of millions. And it was a fairly clubby world. People all had recognizable last names like DuPont and Merrill and Rockefeller and Astor. And they all joined the same clubs. They went to the same boarding schools. It was a really close-knit world, more, as I say in the book, like a village than a country. In the 1980s, you started to have the convergence of globalization, technological advancement in computers, and the incredible explosion of financial markets. And these three things sort of have come together to create a perfect storm for the rich and create wealth that's not only bigger than the wealth of the past, but just millions and millions of millionaires. And never before have so many people gotten rich so quickly as they can today.
There are, of course, some historical parallels with the Gilded Age of about 100 years ago.
Sure.
And the 1920s. How does the present like or unlike those previous periods?
Well, it's similar in that, you have another spike in wealth. I call it the third wave because after the Gilded Age and the Roaring Twenties, this is really is the third significant spike in wealth in America. But it's different in size, scale, and speed. I mean, in the 1920s and the 1800s, the late 1800s, it took John D. Rockefeller until his 50s to make his first million. And, you know, we have 30-year-olds today, like the Google guys, who are worth $14 billion. And even if you account for inflation from Rockefeller's period, it's never been possible in American history for people to make so much so quickly at a very early age. So it's the size of the fortunes, again, you know, $14 billion, and it's the youth and the speed with which you can make that money.
Yeah, and Forbes introduced its 400 list in around 1982.
Right.
And the price of admission in those days was relatively small compared to what it is now. Now everybody on the list is a billionaire, right?
Yeah, to get on the Forbes list today, you need to be worth at least $1 billion. And I think back then, I mean, when the Forbes list started in 1982, I think to get on the list, you needed maybe $60 or $80 million. And, you know, now everyone's a billionaire. And the wealth of that group continues to grow astronomically as well. So, but it's not just the Forbes list. I mean, no matter what category you look at with wealth, the entry-level price for being, quote, rich in America has gone up.
I'm speaking with Robert Frank, who is a Wall Street Journal reporter and the author of the book Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lies of the New Rich. You have a little taxonomy of these of Richistan, lower, middle, and upper. Give us a little view of just who inhabits these three realms.
Sure. Well, you know, I used to think that you became rich and the rich were all sort of similar, and, you know, once you had a certain amount of money, it didn't matter what you had beyond that. Well, I learned in my year in Richistan that, in fact, there are at least three distinct levels in Richistan. Lower Richistan, which is when you have a million or more in net worth. Middle Richistan, where you need 10 million to get in. And upper Richistan, where you have to be worth 100 million. And then there's Billionaireville, which is the top. And what I found is that your life and your spending and your habits and your whole view of the world within these categories is shaped a lot by how much money you have. In other words, the lower Richistanis are very different in how they lead their lives and how they spend, how they invest, and how money relates to their identity compared to the upper Richistan folks, for instance.
And how are they different?
Well, it's just, I mean, take spending. For instance, upper Richistanis, they spend an average of $182,000 a year on watches alone. And then lower Richistanis spend, you know, probably around $2,000 a year on watches. The lower Richistanis, most of them made their money, they're working people. They own small businesses maybe, but most of them are professionals, lawyers, doctors, that sort of thing. Upper Richistanis, almost all of them are entrepreneurs who have started their own company and sold it. So you get very different personality types.
Now, it does seem that the rich today are different from the rich of many generations ago, in that the old rich were often coupon clippers, you know, the classic idle rich.
Right.
Now there seems to be something of an imperative to work. Even the socialites of today have to, like Tinsley Mortimer, have to pretend they're their handbag entrepreneurs or something. So is that a correct impression? Is that what you found? These people still are driven to work in some way?
It's true. I say that the idle rich have been replaced by the workaholic wealthy. And you know, it was surprising to me. There's a profile in the book of a guy named Tim Blixith who is worth about $1.2 billion, and he's retired twice in his life. He's only in his mid-50s. But, you know, he made a certain amount of money and retired and then realized that was not interesting to him, did it again, made another pile of money, retired, and realized, look, you know, these people are addicted to work. They're addicted to projects. They love building houses, building yachts, creating companies. And then once that project is done, they lose interest and, you know, they're done with it. But they're just addicted to work. They're addicted to projects. They're addicted to creating things. And I think it's part of being an entrepreneur today. But it makes for a very different kind of rich people than we used to have. In Palm Beach today, most of the people in Palm Beach are running their companies from their pool houses or in their house. It used to be nobody worked in Palm Beach.
Well, that sounds interesting in some sense, but also it suggests, I don't know, a certain lack of inner resources an inability to enjoy themselves. It's almost as if the constant busyness is a defense against something.
Well, yeah, and I think that's a very perceptive point. I mean, I'm not sure each of these people has different things going on psychologically. They all have chips on their shoulder and things to prove and all sorts of deeper issues, but, you know, enjoying yourself, the ability to just say, you know, I've done well, I'm going to sit back, I'm going to try to enjoy life and maybe give back to the community. It doesn't come naturally to these people. They're constantly competing. They're constantly sort of climbing to the next rung. And, you know, I mean, the good part about it is they are always creating companies and they're creating a lot of jobs in the process. But the old wealth, the sense that, you know, you should lead a refined and dignified life and just enjoy the privilege that you have, maybe take up art collecting or painting or sail a boat around the world. It doesn't appeal to these people. So I think there is something lacking there that they're trying to fill in their own lives through all buying all these things and starting all these companies.
Now, what about conflicts between this kind of new money and the old money, which doesn't look all that rich compared to the new money? But I remember there's a story in the book, which I believe was also a story in the Wall Street Journal, about the inflatable pool toy guy who made his money and wanted to invade Palm Beach society.
Right. Yeah, the chapter's called Barbarians in the Ballroom, and this the inflatable pool toy magnate you mentioned, his name is Simon Fireman. He, after getting involved in some scandals, political scandals in Massachusetts, went down to Palm Beach to kind of reinvent himself as this great charitable leader, gave a lot of money to the Red Cross, and essentially took over the Red Cross Ball, which in Palm Beach is the yearly event for the blue blood aristocrats down there. But he bought his way into that ball and became chairman. And Blue Blood Society in Palm Beach, they boycotted. It was a huge scandal. There was all sorts of fights going on. And eventually, last year, the whole thing erupted in further scandal. He was kicked out. The Red Cross, you know, had to find another chairman. And Simon Fireman, at the ball I was at, literally fell on his face on Donald Trump's ballroom floor in disgrace because he had just never been accepted by Palm Beach society. And the reason that he wasn't accepted is because the old money, they value humility, they value giving anonymously to charity. You know, and these were things that Simon Fireman was not about.
Well, back in the late 80s, I think, was that reason or is it earlier than that, when Saul Steinberg tried to take over a chemical bank, the old money people said, no, you're not allowed, and he lost. It looks these days that the new rich are winning more of these battles. Is it your sense that they really are finally the barbarians are breaking through the gates?
They are, and even though Simon Fireman was sort of rejected in Palm Beach, I think you're right. If you look at what's happening on the charity and museum circuit in New York or in the museum and charity circuit in L.A., you'll see that basically money talks. And, you know, the old money that still sits on many of these cultural institutional boards and charities is getting literally pushed out because the new folks are saying, look, I'll give you $100 million for this new hospital wing or this new symphony hall, but you got to put me on the board. You got to get rid of this guy who's only giving you $1 million a year. And so these old blue blood folks are really being removed from the social scene across America because this new money is just so much bigger. You know, if you were DuPont in Palm Beach 10 years ago and you were worth $7 million, you were something special. Now, you know, you're not.
I was speaking with Robert Frank, author of the book Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich, just out from Crown. What about politics? Are these people getting involved in politics at all?
They certainly are, and that was another area that was surprising to me. Not that they were getting involved in politics, but the reasons they were getting involved in politics was interesting to me. If you look at Michael Bloomberg, he's a perfect example of, you know, somebody who's very wealthy, who's getting involved in politics not with a platform of, you know, cut taxes on the wealthy or let's you know, get rid of regulations because we want to make rich people more rich, or you know, what they're doing is, at least in their stump speeches, focusing on policies that are aimed at broader community. And so there's a guy I profile in Colorado who has done a lot for schools there. He's a multimillionaire, 30 years old, and his philanthropy had gotten to a certain point where he realized he could only do so much on his own as a philanthropist. What he really needed to do to improve education was to go into government himself. So now he's running for Congress. And to me, it was very different from the old sort of Reaganite Republicans who defined the wealthy and their politics for years.
Of course, the Walton family is still doing that sort of Reaganite politics.
Exactly. And many of them, you know, and that's the sort of big to be sure here, many of the big wealthy families, especially those who have inherited their wealth, like the Waltons, are pushing for repealing the estate tax. They're pushing for, you know, further reductions in dividend taxes and all these things. So, and those people clearly have been successful on a national level in recent years. But I think that the Bloombergs of the world, the Jared Polises of the world out in Colorado, these people are gonna really redefine the way the wealthy influence politics.
And let's return to the happiness question.
Yeah.
The surveys show that people do get happier as they get richer.
Right.
Rich people are generally happier than poor people. But it does seem like there's a ceiling on this, that after a certain point, that happiness effect doesn't work anymore. So the people up here in Richistan, especially those in Upper Richistan, does all that money buy happiness?
Well, you know, the studies are very accurate, and they reflect, you know, what my reporting found, which is that they certainly help to a point. But once you have the jet, once you have the boat, once you have the three houses, you know, everything you add to that just complicates your life. And there's a guy I interviewed in the book who told me, he said, look, here's how complicated my life is. There was a mouse in his house, and he said, in order to get rid of this mouse, I had to email my household manager. Household manager called a pest control company. They caught the mouse. Then we had to get two outside staff people come in and remove the mouse. He said it was five people to remove this mouse from my house. And so, you know, money brings happiness to a certain point. But after a certain point, it makes your life so complicated and you become so distrustful of other people that you're pretty miserable.
More money, more problems, as
exactly.
the rapper said.
Exactly.
But I also imagine it might be hard for some people who may be contending with rats in their houses to work up too much sympathy for this fellow.
Right.
It does seem like it leads to an atrophy of certain social skills, and maybe they weren't there in the first place.
Well, exactly. And one of the other chapter in the book that's interesting as it relates to social skills is what's happening to today's kids. There is an estimated $15 trillion that's about to pass from parents to their kids. And if you look at what's happening with Paris Hilton, just think of that multiplied times, you know, a million. And
now, Paris Hilton swore to Larry King she doesn't do drugs and she doesn't have a drinking problem.
Right, right, and we all believe her.
Yes.
And, you know, if you look at what's happening with today's kids, a lot of these parents are giving their kids the things they didn't have growing up, because remember, many of today's rich did not grow up rich. They made their own money. And so with their children, they're spoiling them, but they also at the same time want their kids to have, quote, middle-class values, you know, the same hardworking ethics that made them successful. And so what they're doing, there's a chapter in my book, they're sending them to these special camps in the summer where the kids learn to manage all the money they're about to inherit and become kind of responsible adults. And it was clear to me in this camp that, you know, these kids growing up in their bubbles of wealth in Palm Beach or Greenwich or wherever, they just have no survival skills, no investing skills, and no kind of real sense about, you know, how to be a normal, socially engaged, productive person.
Well, the contrast with John D. Rockefeller is striking, because he required his kids to weed the front lawn up in Westchester for the payment of one penny for every 10 weeds they extracted. So I don't think they're doing that sort of thing, are they?
No, and there's, I interviewed a couple of sort of old money types who told me about their summer jobs, you know, digging ditches, and one guy worked in a morgue for a summer. And, you know, you just can't imagine today's, 90210 crowd doing any of these things. I mean, not just having really difficult jobs, but just not working, period. Many of these kids in the camp I went to were in their mid-20s, had never been on a job interview in their life.
We've only got like 45 seconds remaining, but can this last? I mean, the previous two waves of wealth collapsed one way or another, and will this one survive?
Everything has a cycle. I think this too shall pass, for better or worse. Unfortunately or fortunately, I don't see this wealth boom fizzling anytime soon. The forces that are creating all this wealth continue, if anything, to accelerate. So look in the coming years for more millionaires and for Richistan to get even bigger.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Robert Frank, a reporter from the Wall Street Journal, who writes their wealth blog and is the author of Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich. And we'll be back after Station ID.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
And we're back. My name is Doug Henwood, the show Behind the News. And just thinking back in that last segment, I'm reminded of Marx's great quote, "Expropriate the expropriators." And let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to listen to Carlos Mejia.
I got a friend, he's a purebred killing machine. He said he's waiting.
And not an excerpt from a song from last summer, Everybody's Gone to War by Narina. I don't know whether she's a French extraction, but is British, whether she says Palot or Pallot. But it's Narina, P-A-L-L-O-T, and a very catchy song about a grim subject. Everybody's Gone to War. And here's someone who decided to go away from war, who refused to become a killing machine any longer, or be a killing machine any longer. And that is Camila Mejia, who was in the Florida National Guard, got called up to Iraq, spent some time there, and when he was on leave here in the United States, decided not to go back to his post in Iraq, and became the first high-profile political deserter from that war. And he's got a new book out from the New Press called The Road from Aramadi, The Private Rebellion of Staff Sergeant. The Private Rebellion of Staff Sergeant Camila Mejia. And I recorded this interview when he was in town earlier this week. Let's listen to it. Camila Mejia. Welcome, Camila. First, give us a sketch of how you got from Nicaragua to Iraq.
Well, my parents were really involved with the Sandinista Revolution in the 70s. And at one point, the leadership, there was a split in the Sandinista leadership, and because of that split, my mother was left without much guidance, you know, as a revolutionary. And at the time, I was just months old. She and my dad were not getting along too well, so she separated from my father and came to the U.S., and we lived here for some time, and then we went to Costa Rica, which is her native country. And then after the victory, the Sandinista victory, we went back to Nicaragua, and we just kept coming back to the U.S., and we lived in Cuba for a while, but for the most part, we stayed in Nicaragua for the entire Sandinista period. And then once Sandinistas lost the election, we went back to Costa Rica for some time, and then to the U.S. So I ended up actually graduating from high school here, and I went to college for a couple of semesters in Miami. And at that time, you know, I had been traveling around so much in my life that I didn't really have a sense of belonging. And, you know, my life had gone from being like a very privileged young man, you know, living in both Nicaragua and Costa Rica, to being working class and not knowing how I was going to get myself an education. And so basically the same reasons that lead young people in the U.S. to join the military were the same reasons that led me to join the U.S. Army, you know. But part of that was like a need to belong somewhere, and the military seemed to offer all those things.
I'm wondering how typical is that. There's a common opinion that it's poverty that drives people into the military. Is that the whole story, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, I think that's a big part of it. I think in my case it was poverty, but it was also, you know, the need to belong somewhere. And I think it's all tied to the lack of options. You know, if it's not because you need a job, it's because maybe you feel like you need adventure, or you need independence, or maybe, you know, you want to get out of a gang, or maybe you just want to get out of a small town. And the only way that you see that materializing is through the military.
And in your period of active duty, you spent that mostly in the United States, right? You didn't. It was only when you were finished with your period of active duty that you got shipped off to Iraq. That was a bit of a surprise to me. I didn't realize that the commitment is as long as it is.
Right. Well, yeah, I did a period of active duty in Texas, Georgia, and California. And then when I got out of the active duty, I still had a commitment of 4.5 years, because every military contract is 8 years long. So when I was done with my 3.5 years of active duty, I still had 4.5. And then when I came to the end of my 8-year military service, which I had done in the Florida National Guard, Congress had passed a stop loss, which is a law by which they can extend soldiers against their will. And I got extended from the year 2003, which was the end of my 8-year service, to the year 2031. And I was activated for a minimum of 2 years in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. So my contract went from, my service went from being 3.5 years to 8 years to, you know, 26 years.
So any 2-year period during that 26-year period, they could call you up?
technically they can. If you ask a recruiter, the recruiter will tell you no. That's just a number that they use for administrative purposes. But what it does, it gives them the legal ability to extend people, like, or to activate people 2 years at a time until they no longer need them. So the likelihood of me staying in the military until the year 2031 is very low. But what it does, it just like gives them this huge window to keep activating you as much as, or as many times as they need you.
Which is a way of having a draft without a draft.
Exactly what some people are calling the backdoor draft. And it's that, you know, it's the stop loss, and it's also the threat of stop loss. You know, a lot of servicemen and women are being told that they need to reenlist, because if they reenlist, they get a bonus. And if they don't reenlist, then they'll get stop loss and they'll get no money. So they're staying anyway. Might as well reenlist and get some money out of it. So a lot of people are reenlisting because they don't want to be stop loss. So it assumes different shapes, but it's what people are calling the backdoor draft.
And from the point of view of the military, they're getting people with experience, with training, with discipline, or used to being in the Army. So it's not, they're not getting raw recruits as they did in the old days.
Well, that's true, but at the same time, you know, they're getting a lot of people who are getting, you know, really burnt out, because you have, you know, back in the Vietnam War, you had conscription, but you had people serving for 1 year and then never going back to Vietnam unless they wanted to. This time around, you had people going back to Iraq a third and even a fourth time. So, you know, the troops are really being stretched thin, and it's just creating a lot of disaffection and a lot of resentment within the ranks.
So you arrived in Iraq. What were your duties when you got there?
Well, I was an infantryman, and our first mission was we got assigned to this improvised jail in a place called Al-Asad. And what we did there, we kept prisoners on sleep deprivation. You know, we performed mock executions, and we just humiliated these people and inflicted fear in their hearts in order to keep them awake for periods of up to 72 hours in order to, quote-unquote, soften them up for interrogation. And that was the first mission. And
is this kind of treatment legal, or is this pushing the envelope?
This is very illegal.
Illegal,
yeah. This is considered torture. And then after that, we went to different places, but we finally ended up being stationed at a place called Al Ramadi. And in Al Ramadi, we just basically conducted all kinds of combat missions. But the way that these combat missions were conducted, you know, everything was done with complete disregard for the rules of war and for the rules of the infantry. And there was a widespread sense that we were doing a lot of the things wrong on purpose so that we would instigate firefights and so that our unit would return home with Purple Hearts and all kinds of combat awards and things like that.
Yeah, you got chewed out by a commanding officer for surviving an ambush and playing it by the book.
Exactly, because they wanted me to order my squad to stay at an ambush site and to call backup, which at that time backup was not really effective. So it would have been quite suicidal on my part to order my squad to stay and fight, but that's exactly what they wanted us to do, because they said that they wanted to send a strong message to the enemy that we were not afraid. But this is not the way that you're supposed to do things in combat. You know, according to the training, you're supposed to return fire and then get out of the kill zone, but they wanted me to stay in the kill zone and just fight. And this is the first of many missions, you know, of that kind, you know, when you know you're supposed to do things a certain way and you end up just basically doing the opposite in order to, you know, to bring the enemy out and to infuriate the population and to instigate firefights. And, you know, the end result of that was, for the most part, you know, that Iraqi civilians were being killed.
So how did you think and feel about what you were doing?
There was a conflict, there was a moral conflict within me, but as time went on, the missions got more dangerous. Not that the missions got more dangerous, but, you know, the resistance got more organized and better equipped, and it became just a matter of survival for myself and the majority of the people in my unit. So it was really hard to stop and really think about what the right thing to do was, or, you know, the morality of it. You know, you basically, I just I was too concerned with surviving and coming home alive.
It seems to me that you could put the most decent moral person in the world in a situation like that, and the pressures, the stress, the fear would just make him impossible to act or think morally, right? It's just the situation like that is a monstrous situation to put people in.
Absolutely. It's what Representative Murtha has called, you know, an atrocity producing situation. You put any kind of human being in that type of extreme fear and confusion and frustration, and you know, the line between right and wrong just basically vanishes. You know, it's just really hard to not, you know, to fight off that instinct to survive, you know, and to just think morally when you're being shot at all the time.
How did your colleagues think of what they were doing? Did they think about the politics of the war? Did they think about why they were there, or did they just view it as a job?
Well, there wasn't really a whole lot of political discussion in my unit. There's this culture of fear and silence in the military. You're not really supposed to talk about the mission or like how much sense the mission makes or if it's sound politically or tactically. You know, you're supposed to just follow orders. But there was a lot of disaffection in terms of the lack of mission and the lack of a real plan. And with the lack of equipment, you know, we were out there in combat missions without bulletproof vests. And at one point, we had to suspend patrols for a while because we didn't have enough water. And, you know, we're talking about 130-degree temperatures. You know, there was a lot of grumbling around because of, on one hand, you know, how we were conducting missions, you know, in a way that didn't make any sense, you know, in terms of the training. And on the other hand, because we're out there doing all this, conducting all these combat missions, and we don't have the proper equipment. So, you know, you hear back home that people are saying, support the troops, but, you know, on the ground, you know, you're going out into war without basic gear. So, although there wasn't really a whole lot of just political discussion about weapons of mass destruction or Saddam Hussein or anything, there was a lot of disaffection with the government and the mission and how things were being carried out because of how we're being shortchanged.
I'm speaking with Camilo Mejia, author of the book Road from Al Ramadi, about his experiences as a soldier in Iraq and as a deserter for political reasons from the U.S. Army.
Did the soldiers think about the public at home? Did they feel supported, opposed, neglected, forgotten?
Well, this was the very beginning of the war, and we weren't really getting a whole lot of feedback from home. You know, we were not really getting a lot of what was happening. You know, the contractors were just getting to where we were, to Ramadi, and we had a TV, but we didn't have any cable. We had a DVD player, and you know, we couldn't listen to the radio or anything like that. Slowly, the internet made its way, but most people just used it to communicate via email with their loved ones. So there wasn't really a whole lot of information going around. So we didn't really know what was happening at home.
So how did you make the decision to leave?
Well, I was given a two-week furlough to come home, and I didn't really make the decision. I was here in the States, and I was trying to get out of the military the legal way, by calling into question my extension and my deployment. But when that didn't work, and it was time for me to get back on the plane, you know, I mean, part of me knew that I shouldn't get on the plane because I didn't want to be a part of what was happening in Iraq, because I didn't believe in the war politically, but also because of, you know, how we were really brutalizing that country and mistreating prisoners and killing civilians. But on the other hand, I also felt guilt for not going back to my comrades, you know, the people in my squad particularly, and because I was afraid of being court-martialed and being sent to jail for a long time. In time of war, desertion could be punished by death. So I was really afraid. There was a lot of fear and there was guilt. And, I mean, there was moral clarity as far as not going back to the war, because it's just the wrong war. It's criminal and immoral, but there was a lot of fear. So I just didn't get on the plane, dog. You know, I didn't, you know, I wish I could say I made a decision that this is the right thing, so I'm not going back, but I didn't. You know, I said to myself that I would go back the next day, and then I didn't, and then I said to myself that I would go back the next day, and then I didn't. And then one day I just realized that I couldn't go back to Iraq, so I just, you know, I came to the Northeast, and I started preparing a legal case to go into a court-martial, and I started writing a conscientious objector claim and, you know, giving clandestine interviews about why I didn't go back. And so it was a long process before I actually gathered the strength to say no, to go public and to say, no, this is not a good war, and this is why I'm not fighting it.
You were underground for, what, 4 or 5 months?
For about 5 months, yes.
And then you decided to, you would then surrender to the military eventually. So how did you go about preparing to do that?
Well, I had an attorney in Boston, and he was himself a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, faced 25 years in jail. And I was also helped by someone in New York City, a citizen soldier, and he helped with Todd Ensign, helped with the public relations part and the fundraising, and then I, you know, I wrote a conscientious objector claim, and I gave interviews, and it all helped, you know, put things into perspective and, you know, clarify things, and, you know, before I knew it, I was ready to go public.
So then you surrendered to the military. How did the military welcome you?
Well, they didn't quite know what was happening because I was the first combat veteran to go public in his refusal to go back to the war. And I was very critical. You know, I called the war criminal. I said it was oil-driven. I said that I was not a mercenary. And, you know, I talked about war crimes and I talked about torture. And it got huge. You know, I got a lot of media attention and all eyes were on me. So they couldn't do...
I was surprised at the time how sympathetic the media attention was. You were not vilified in the coverage I read. Did that surprise you?
Well, there was some vilification, but no, for the most part, you're right. No, it was pretty... I mean, the fact that they covered it the way that they did is, you know, speaks volumes of, you know, how at least sectors of the media were sympathetic. I was very surprised, yes, I was very surprised because we never thought that we were going to get that much attention. And the military obviously didn't know what was happening, so they, for a while, they didn't know what to do with me. And there was a period of 2 months where they basically just tried to keep me quiet. You know, they told me I could be interviewed, but I couldn't go off base. They told reporters that I could be interviewed, but that they couldn't come to the base. So, you know, they were playing all these silly games, you know, to keep me quiet. And then eventually, you know, they charged me with desertion, and 2 months after my surrender, I was tried by a court-martial.
And sentenced to, you served a year?
Sentenced to 12 months of incarceration and demotion to the lowest rank and forfeiture of my pay and a bad conduct discharge. I ended up serving about 9 months. I got out 3 months early because of good conduct.
I was expecting a much longer sentence. I thought they were going to make an example of you since you were the first to go public and very explicitly politically so. So getting a year was a bit of a surprise. Were you surprised by that?
We were pleasantly surprised, yes. And I think that part of that was that back then much was being said about President Bush's military service and how he had gone AWOL. And one of the things that my attorney said was that, you know, they expected me to be dealt with administratively, just like Bush was. So there was a lot of attention around the president having gone AWOL, and I think that may have played a role. And also the fact that, you know, I talked about torture, and weeks after my surrender, the Abu Ghraib scandal broke out. So I don't know. I suppose that they felt like they had to be careful about how to handle me because they wouldn't want, you know, the public to be outraged or to start asking, you know, tougher questions about, you know, why is this guy being tried, you know, when he tried to raise awareness about torture and when he actually did serve in the war and the president did not. It's hard to know why, you know, we can all only speculate.
And how are you treated when you're in prison by your fellow inmates and the guards?
Well, again, I had a lot of attention around me, so the guards could not really harass me without all kinds of alarms going off. So they had to be careful with me, and the inmates were really supportive, because when you go to an army jail, the people in the jail no longer feel like they owe silence to the military. They no longer feel like they can't think for themselves because they've already been tried and they feel like they've got nothing to lose. So they're pretty honest and they speak their minds in jail. And, you know, by and large, I was supported.
And have you been able to put your life together again after getting out of jail, getting back into civilian life?
Yes, actually, I think that jail helped me. I think that my time in jail was actually a time for me to think about everything and to just to sort of be sheltered from the media and to not have to, you know, be out there, being interviewed or being harassed by the military. You know, I had a structure and a discipline, and I could count on that to think and to write and to heal from my war and my underground experience.
And what are you doing now? How do you spend your days?
Well, I do fundraising for an organization that helps veterans deal with military and war trauma. And
what's the organization?
It's called Vets for Vets. And I do activism to stop the war. And I have a very beautiful 7-year-old little girl who I'm raising. And I'm promoting my memoir, Road from Ramadi.
Oh, well, good luck. Thanks for all you've done.
And that was Camila Mejia, who is the author of the book Road from Ramadi, The Private Rebellion of Staff Sergeant Camila Mejia, talking about his experience in Iraq and deserting the U.S. Army and becoming an activist against that brutal, criminal, hideous, disastrous war. And I guess a little time left over, but maybe I'll just go out a little early tonight because I don't have anything else to say. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with the usual proto-weekend party track. This from, who is this from? This is from Kissy Sellout, Get Ready for the K-Hole. Really rousing piece of dance music. Kissy Sellout, reportedly the hot DJ in London this summer. But what do I know? I just know what I read on the web. So, get ready for the K-Hole. Till next week. Bye. Come back for more.